allow her into the
sure. How much time is she?
15 minutes.
I'll call together to order the House Committee on Health Care. And for those of you that are interested, let me give you the order of the bills we intend to hear today. We'll first hear 2464. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, we'll then go to 2465 and end with 2455. So that's where we're going. And I'll open the first public hearing on 2464, and we'll ask Sally Pipes to come to the podium, please. Thank you for coming from afar. If you please introduce yourself.
Thank you for having me. My name is Sally Pipes, and I am president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. I'm also an economist and a healthcare economist, and have been working in the field since I lived in Canada most of my life until I moved to the United States and became an American citizen in December 2006. So, should I begin?
Oh, please. Okay. I'm sorry.
So I'd like to thank you for allowing me to offer remarks today. I think few issues are as important as healthcare policy. Nationally, Americans consume about $2.3 trillion on healthcare, and that accounts for about 15 to 16% of our economy. Here in Oregon, you're spending about 13% on healthcare, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. I think everybody would agree that we want affordable, accessible, quality health care for everyone. But the real question is, how do we achieve that? And there are two competing visions for health care reform, one which relies on market-based solutions, empowering doctors and consumers, and encouraging innovation in drugs, biologics, and medical devices. The other relies on increasing the role of government in our health care system through taxes, subsidies, and mandates. Today in America, 47% of health care is in the hands of government, whether it's through Medicare, Medicaid, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, or the VA system. There are two main problems with health care. One is the lack of third-party coverage and the cost, and the second is the cost of health care. Our decentralized health care system relies today on employer-sponsored private insurance, taxpayer-financed insurance for the poor, children of lower-income families, and the elderly, and private individual policies for those without access to either of those. There is no single plan that covers everyone's health care expenses. The solution, which I'm going to talk about in health care in general, is to provide individuals with insurance either by increasing the coverage of existing public plans, creating new public programs, or mandating that the private sector offer to subsidize plans for everyone and that people in turn purchase coverage with their own money. According to data from the U.S. Department of Labor, their survey of consumer expenditures, the average American household today spends $2,800 out of pocket on health care, including insurance premiums, or 5.7% of income. By contrast, the same household spends $2,600 on dining out, $2,600 on entertainment, and $2,200 on their income taxes, a portion of which no doubt funds one or someone else's health care consumption. I wanted to just generally talk about HB 2009, which is your overall bill. I think that this bill is very much modeled on the Massachusetts politically successful bill, which was passed in April 2006. That was what we called Romney Care. It seeks to provide universal insurance coverage by expanding each of the channels that provide third-party coverage for healthcare services. private plans may be expanded by requiring employers to pay or play, and that is also part of President Obama's health care agenda. A new public plan may be created for people who prefer it to private plans or for whom premiums are too high. This is also an element of Obama's health care agenda, part of his campaign. The plan that is outlined in HB 2009 offers new government bureaucracy to regulate and control the health care sector in the state of Oregon. A government-established Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, which will determine the elements of plans offered in the private market, i.e. community rating, guaranteed issue, and mandates, approve or set prices of the plans in the exchange, and determine the terms on which they can be offered. An Oregon Health Authority Board will be created to coordinate this new system. Under it, you will have the Oregon Health Authority. Together, they are empowered to oversee the insurance exchange and create practice and quality guidelines. They will explore individual mandates, taxing employers through this pay-or-play or payroll tax, and create a new government health care program, as Mr. Obama is also talking about. The authority's main goal seems to be controlling health care costs. The authority will be charged with keeping cost increases to 1% below the increase in the U.S. Consumer Price Index. Thus, as I see it, with a few strokes of the pen, a few hundred pages of text, and a few hundred new bureaucrats here, Oregon will have solved both the problems that are plaguing American health care, third-party coverage and expensive health care. Access should be expanded and costs controlled. The broad design, Oregon's health care reform, reflects both the current wisdom of the Obama administration and Romney Care of 2006. You're welding the Massachusetts plan and with the connector to former HHS nominee Tom Daschle's Federal Health Board idea. An examination of the record indicates that the structure you are talking about will not achieve the goals that you have outlined. It will, however, increase costs and put thousands more people on taxpayer-sponsored health care. The health care connector, outside of an enforced individual mandate, will not achieve universal coverage. In Massachusetts, where the plan will be 3 years old this April, where about 10% of Massachusetts Bay Staters were uninsured at the time Romney Care came into being, still today 5% of people in Massachusetts, even though there's an individual and employer mandate, are still without insurance. The bulk of the people who have signed up for insurance have signed up for what we call Commonwealth Care, which is the free or subsidized insurance. Very few people signed up for Commonwealth Choice, the private sector plan. And these people would rather pay a fine and lose their income tax deduction than buy still expensive insurance. The plans in Massachusetts are so expensive and the prices have gone up that the government decided they had to exempt 20% of the uninsured from purchasing them. Yet even then, people were expected to pay up to 10% of household income on insurance or face these fines. Policymakers here in Oregon will be stuck with the untenable choice of forcing people to purchase plans that they can't afford or fining them for doing so. Hillary Clinton, when she was in the race against Obama for the Democratic nomination, was interviewed by George Stephanopoulos on This Week, and she was a big supporter of the individual mandate. George said to her, "Hillary, how do you enforce an individual mandate?" And she said, "Well, George, one of the ways is we can garnish you wages. There are very few ways that you can force people to buy insurance. In California, 25% of drivers are driving around without car insurance, even though it's mandated." So the Massachusetts plan has been expensive. Most of the people that have signed up for Commonwealth care, free or subsidized. The system the health care system, Romney Care, is $147 million over budget, and Governor Deval Patrick is wringing his hands, wondering how he's going to deal with this. If a public system were open to the public at subsidized prices, it's going to prompt people to drop their private coverage and pick up these public plans. This is what we call crowding out, and it's happened In Hawaii, a state children's health insurance plan introduced for all children, and Linda Lingle, the governor, after 3 months said so many people had dropped private insurance for their children to move into the state program that they had to discontinue it. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that for every 100 children added to taxpayer rolls under the state children's health insurance program, 25 to 50 of these children drop their private coverage. So, in conclusion, a few general thoughts. Obviously, all the details of your 298-page bill cannot be addressed in the short amount of time that I have. But it is clear that this bill is a product of its time and reflects infatuation with government design, government decision-making, and control. We are to believe that bodies of experts overseen by people appointed by politicians and served by career bureaucrats can determine the very best healthcare practices, what all plans ought to cover and what they ought not to, get the price right on third-party payer, and determine which citizens deserve to be explicitly subsidized by others or not. This proposed scheme will radically increase the expenditures that flow through the state government healthcare bureaucracy. To the extent that you do increase your third-party coverage, it is going to be very expensive for taxpayers. To the extent that costs explode, it will merely fan the flames again for a single-payer healthcare system under which expenditures are tightly controlled with budgets, such as in Canada, where I'm from. Canada spends 10% of its gross domestic product on healthcare because that's what the government says the amount will be. As a result, in Canada, we have long waiting lists, ration care, and lack of access to the latest technology. The average wait in Canada today, 2008, 17.3 weeks, that's over 4 months, from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist. We rank very low within the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in terms of CAT scans, MRIs, and positron emission tomography. So if you want government to set a global budget, it'll have to be controlled, and you will have long waiting lists, ration care, and lack of access to positron emission tomography and all of these great inventions that we have here in America. Thank you. And then I was going to say a few words, if I have time, about your AB 2464.
You've got five more minutes.
Oh, good. This is the Oregon Public Employees Benefit Board currently offers a great array of health plans for your public employees, from HMOs with high premiums to minimal cost sharing for plans that offer more choice with lower premiums, but for more cost sharing at point of service, i.e. co-pays. Absent from your menu is an innovative health option called health savings accounts, which came in January 2004 as part of the federal government's Medicare Modernization Act. Health savings accounts are bank accounts where you can keep your money, and they have to be combined with a high deductible insurance plan. The inclusion of an HSA eligible option would benefit Oregon's employees and taxpayers together. In 2009, the least expensive family plan offered in this state for full-time Oregon employees was $1,028 a month. The most expensive plan was $1,142. If employees of your state did not consume between $12,000 and $13,000 worth of health care, they effectively lost out with no ability to capture that unused money for use in future years. If they contributed to an FSA or a flexible spending account to cover expenses not covered by the health plans, they would face a strong incentive to spend all of this money because you cannot carry that money forward tax-free. It's a use it or lose it. An HSA option would provide an excellent alternative. If HSAs transfer significant control of healthcare expenditures, they transfer them from institutions to individuals, empowering consumers. The high deductible health plan protects families from financial ruin in the event of catastrophic health expenses. The wellness visits, which are free of charge, provide an incentive for annual routine care. The ability to roll over tax-free unused funds in the savings accounts from year to year is a terrific idea. And in a very short number of years, you will be able to accumulate significant resources to supplement future health care expenditures. Funds can be used for any qualified IRS health care expense, including long-term care insurance premiums, or which will save the taxpayers money down the road and reduce nursing home care costs. Consider this. A four-person family with two adults, ages 39 and 42, can purchase an HSA plan in Oregon from Kaiser Permanente, a major provider of state insurance, for $594 a month. This plan covers preventive care and immunizations at no cost. Other procedures are subject to a $5,200 deductible and then a 20% copay up to the annual out-of-pocket maximum of $10,000. In the vast majority of years, families that elect this plan would not reach through the deductible. So, the benefit stems from who controls the surplus in the years of light health care expenditures. So, this is a terrific idea that you can roll over the money not spent in your plan for future years when you might need it. This plan would allow Oregon's public servants to build wealth and security for the future. Assuming an average surplus of $3,000 a year for 25 years and a return of 5%, a public servant would accumulate $150,000 for use for health care expenses in their retirement. This money could pay for retiree health care premiums, long-term care insurance, and other medical expenses that arrive with old age. This would protect individuals' nest eggs, independence, and their dignity. Let me be clear. I am not for mandating HSAs as part of your plan. They are not the best plan for everyone, but they are an important option for many and should be included in a comprehensive menu of health care options. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes.
I think there's a couple down that way, too.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody. Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Pipes. It's an honor to have you here today. I've read your work in the Wall Street Journal and National Review, if I'm not mistaken, to name a couple of places. So
even the Washington Post.
Even the Washington Post. So look, you serve everybody. But anyways, real honor to have you here today. Mr. Chair, I think we could probably have fill a two-hour discussion pretty easily. I don't think we have the time for that. Dr. Pipes, given that... My question to you is more political than it is specific. I adhere to a lot of the same concepts that you do: HSAs, private versus public, let the market, you know, market choices to make it work. But here's a situation that I think we face in Oregon, at least from where I sit, having been a member of the legislature for the last 4 years. We've had careful with the choice of my words. We've had political impasse in recent years in Oregon, and basically what I mean by that is there's been a lot of excellent, in my opinion, a lot of excellent free market oriented healthcare ideas that have been thrown out there and promulgated that have basically gotten nowhere because of the way this building, frankly, you know, the legislature would be of one party, the governor of a different party. Now we're in a situation where that's not the case anymore. There's one party control of this building, and there's now a train rolling, and it's, as you've mentioned, it's House Bill 2009.
Right.
And so I guess, once again, being very delicate and careful with my words here, but given... given that aspect and given that reality, can 2009, in your opinion, and maybe you haven't had enough time to look at it, it's a huge bill, can 2009 be made to work and be effective with largely the components that have been offered through the Oregon Health Fund Board in 2009, yet still engaging in a lot of the policy ideas, including HSAs and otherwise, to make it work in your mind, or is it too close to the Massachusetts system in your mind and it's doomed to failure?
Well, we could spend an hour talking about this. Oregon, of course, you have a similar situation as we have in Washington. You have the governor, and both houses are controlled by the Democratic Party, as they are in Washington. And certainly, I think, in dealing with a lot of important people in the Obama administration, he wants to get health care reform through in 100 days. And we've already seen three major things pass through the stimulus bill, which is comparative effectiveness research, increasing Medicaid, and the COBRA benefit. So in Washington, they're on a path to expanding the role of government in healthcare. I think that you should be very, very careful here in Oregon to copy the Massachusetts plan, because Massachusetts had a very low rate of uninsured. Their uninsured rate when they passed the bill was 10%. Now they are at 5%. But the cost to the budget, the problems that have been caused by setting up a connector authority controlled by bureaucrats, has not solved the problem of the 5% still uninsured. The individual mandate has not worked. And the employer mandate, they had expected to get about $50 million in from pay-or-play employer-based mandates, and they only got $4 million in, because employers change the way they do their business. Some of them, you know, put people on part-time and things. So they didn't get the kind of money they thought. They didn't get the sign-up for Commonwealth Choice. And I think that you should be very, very careful about moving down this path. It would be a different thing if a connector or an exchange authority were all run by the private sector, but they're not. Government bureaucrats are making decisions about what kind of health care people are going to get. And I think it's detrimental to the long-term health of people, and is another way to move us down to single payer. I remember you had a single payer initiative here in Oregon a few years that went down. We've had a couple in California that have gone down, because when people get right down to it, they really realize that they don't like standing in line at the post office, and they don't like standing in line at the DMV, and these are the people that will be running your health care.
You keep using nasty words we try not to, like,
oh,
politician and bureaucrat. It's not polite to use
I'm just
bad
an
language.
I'm just an economist. We get a lot of flack, too.
Yes. Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've only been a politician for a few weeks here now. My first
you were
session.
A bureaucrat. You were a business bureaucrat.
Business bureaucrat.
Yeah.
Okay, not sure, but I'm an entrepreneur. I run a business, and sticking to the HSA portion of the conversation, which is, I think, what the public hearing is about, I perceived this to be a good idea, and I offered it to my employees, 15 of them at the time, 14 here, one of them coincidentally in Massachusetts, the East Coast rep. Not one of them took it. I was surprised. They pointed out that the record-keeping associated with it was beyond what any of them wanted to participate in at all. So while I continue to think that it's a good idea, I'm not sure how widely utilized it would be. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, we have an HSA plan at Pacific Research Institute, and we have about three-quarters of our employees. We have 23 employees who have signed up for the HSA. Mm-hmm. Some of the older people have not signed up for it because they are afraid they won't be able to build in the time they have left to retirement enough money in the HSA to make it worthwhile. So, and I can understand that. But across America today, there are about 7 million health savings accounts have been set up since the passage in January, and since the implementation in January 04 of the Medicare Modernization Act. There has been the surveys that have been done by McKinsey and Company, satisfaction rates have been very high, and same in our office. People have not found the paperwork difficult, and they've been very pleased with it. And, you know, in this country, a lot, because 64% of people in America get their health care through their employer, we have first dollar coverage in this country, i.e., people think health care is virtually free if they don't have to pay part of their premium, or even if they just pay part, or if they pay a copay of $10, $20, $30 or no copay. They think that's what health care costs, and so we have first dollar coverage and people overuse the system. But the health savings account causes people to be more involved in how they spend their health care dollars and what they're using them for. And the McKinsey study showed that people were more likely to get an annual physical having an HSA because they didn't want some condition to grow, and then when they take care of it, it's much more expensive. So I'm very I'm very high on HSAs. Now, on the other hand, I think, you know, with the new administration, certainly I know in a private meeting Hillary Clinton said she wanted to grandfather HSAs. She didn't like people having control of their health care. So, but we have 7 million. I think it's going to be hard to turn back the clock, and they are an option, and they're good for, as I say, not everyone, but they're good for a lot of people, and young people can build up that money tax-free, and it causes them to be concerned and in control of their health care, empowers them to work with their doctors.
She actually said she doesn't like people to be in control of their health care?
I was at a private meeting, but yes.
She actually said that, huh?
Yes, just like she said that government should be able to garnish wages of people if they don't comply with the individual mandate. And garnishing wages of people in America is not the way I think most Americans would like.
The objective of 2009 is to take away the ability of our 600,000 uninsured to take care of their own health care. They don't seem to be doing a very good job of it right now, looks like. Yes, you have a...
No, I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
President Mowers, you want to follow that up? And after that, we'll have Representative Wingard and Arnie Patala. Is that correct? Good. All three of you come up at once.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3, serving most of Josephine County, and I appreciate the chair's opportunity to hear three of my bills. First is House Bill 2464, and it requires PEB to offer the option of a health savings account to public employees. Currently, I live in Southern Oregon, and I have one option of a plan, and that is with Regents. The plan does not require a deductible. I do not pay into that plan, and the state pays an awful lot of money for that plan. In this political climate, I think it would be very
Excuse me a moment.
Someone's
be good if somebody's got a BlackBerry or an iPhone to shut off.
I'm not quite that sophisticated.
You don't even have an HSA.
I don't. I don't need one. Well, I understand the politics in Oregon, and you know, I could offer this as a shot across the bow, punching holes in someone's plan, but I think this is actually a palatable approach that could be acceptable to everybody, because this is a win for everybody. It is a win for PEB because it is possible that some utilization could go down, and that will be addressed. I think it'll be addressed by a later panel. But also, it's a win for employees who today do not utilize significant amounts of health care dollars, because they would be able to set aside money into an account that rolls forward with them from year to year. Unlike our current FSA setup, that money, as was stated earlier, is use it or lose it. And I would much rather be able to keep the dollars that I put into it and either use it or not, because it's tax advantaged, use it or not, and carry it forward from year to year, knowing that at some point in my life, that is very likely that I'm going to use more health care. Even in today's, even under the system that we have now, which is a very rich, under Blue Cross plan, as a family, I am subject to a $3,000 annual out-of-pocket maximum. Now, actually, that isn't really the maximum, because if I were unlucky enough to work in the state for 30 years, and I had significant health needs, I could easily run up against the lifetime maximum of $2 million. And I don't know very many employees. In fact, I don't even know what happens after $2 million. Do they throw you on the street? Do they kick you out of state? I don't know what they do. But the point is that every year I am subject to a $3 out-of-pocket maximum.
State of California. That's
Very well. They could do that. It's warmer. Anyway, to summarize my very brief testimony is I believe that, in fact, this does have some value that it could be offered. And you know what? To Representative Harker's comment about, you know, how many people would take part in this, is we don't know what we don't know. But if there is a no, if it's a no-lose situation for the state of Oregon, and it's only a win for the employees, why not offer the option? I'm looking at Representative Kotek because she's on the board. And so, this is not about taking something away. It's not about a movement to destroy someone's coverage as we see it today. So I would actually appreciate serious consideration of this idea, knowing that there are many ideas that aren't going to gain traction.
Why don't you have all three and then have some questions on the panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Matt Wingert, and I really want to thank you for hearing this bill. And because of Representative Harker's question, I want Arnie to go first, and then I'll talk a little bit about the HSA sheet that I did here on PEB. But I've been waiting a long time to bring this subject up to the legislature, and I really do hope that we get a thorough airing of it, because I agree with Representative Maurer. I think we have a situation here where we have a win-win, maybe even a win-win-win, not a term I like to use. But I'll let Arnie go first, and then I'll conclude.
Great. Thank you very much. Chairman Greenlick and the rest of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Introduce
here.
Yourself, sir.
Oh, sorry, I'm Arnie Patella. I'm an licensed health insurance producer here in the state. Before I get into the testimony, I want to make a comment on a couple of things that have gone on so far. When Sally Pipes testified and talked about the growth of the HSAs now being 7 million HSAs, there could be a lot more if some people would put money in their own HSAs and open one. But there are not. So there are some people that buy these high deductible plans that don't fund them. But it seems like it's slow growth. But I want to tell you, it is faster growth. HSAs in the last 5 years have grown faster than 401ks did when they began. So they are growing quite rapidly. Secondly, on Representative Maurer's comment about a maximum out-of-pocket costs, right now, your current plan does not have a maximum out-of-pocket cost. Once you reach the $3,000, which I said, he said, every time you go to the doctor, you still have to pay a copay. Every time you get prescription drugs, you have to pay for the copay for the prescription drugs. HSAs actually have a true maximum out-of-pocket cost that says once you're there, everything is free. At least out of your pocket, is paid for by the insurance company. I just want to go on with the testimony then. The question really is, do HSA plans work? And if they do, why wouldn't the state government adopt them? Manitowoc County, Wisconsin, face the same budget issues that other local state governments do in 2007. A quote by the county executive says, either taxes would need to go up dramatically on a regular basis or we'd have to shed employees. Our costs are approaching $20,000 per year on a family plan. So what did they do? They offered a choice of plans. One could purchase the normal $500 deductible copay plan for 8% of the premium. The second choice was an HSA plan in which the family would pay nothing for the coverage. The family would get $5,600 into their health savings account, because that was the legal limit at the time. And the taxpayers would save $2,000 per employee. Now, I haven't been able to follow up, because that plan has just been in force over a year. But I have my own experience with that, since about 50% of my clients have HSAs. I established one, first one in April 2004, and it was only legal since January 2004. And I did it for the belief that until consumers demanded that prices and quality become transparent, the healthcare community wasn't going to offer that. And so what we are starting to see now is as these consumer-driven plans expand, we have started to see the transparency start to be devolved, and some of those, it's not quite to the degree we want it yet, but I anticipate they will get there. So with regard to Oregon, it would seem to me, and I didn't know what the figures were with regard to what PEB charges and everything like this, but I think Sally had said that so a family plan could get a health savings account for $600 from Kaiser. And by the way, every carrier in the state of Oregon does offer an HSA plan. It's probably a $2,500 deductible, Mitch. So, if that was the case, if you take your most expensive plan and that you're paying for right now, and you use that amount of money to fund both the high deductible health plan and the HSA, my guess is you'd have more than enough to fund the HSA, so you couldn't fund it all the way. In other words, because IRS has limits at the top, the amount of money you would probably save would exceed those limits, and so the state therefore would be able to save some money on it. The second thing I've noticed about some of my clients who have done this is behavior changes. They use more generic drugs. They do get those physical exams that Sally talked about. They do, for example, myself, I negotiated $3,000 off a surgery from a surgeon before he gave it to me. And a lot of people said, I wouldn't have discussions like that with my employer or my physician, especially before surgery. But I mean, we do it with everybody else, now why not with them? And the individual is willing to do that. And why? It's because I took off my glasses and I got a little teary-eyed and said, geez, I got to pay for the whole thing myself. Can't you give me a break? And it worked. So I'm saying what happens, at least with the clients that I have, they actually do talk to their physicians. They do negotiate. They actually go to pharmacists and say, is there another equivalent drug that is less costly?
What's the point about Harker's saying why most people don't choose it?
Oh, yeah. Representative Harker's why most people don't choose it is because they're afraid of the high deductible. Frankly, when I go in front of a group because I've perfected my pitch as strongly as I have, about 50% of the people in the plan, in a company, take it. And the difficulty is the communication. People just don't get it. And once you get them across where they really do get it, it really makes a sense.
Could you wrap it up, Mr. President?
Yeah, one last point. I've sold a lot of HSAs. If you look at the way I get paid, a lot of people would say, you must make more money selling HSAs than you do regular plans. That's not correct. We get less money because we only get paid on the insurance portion of it, which is a lot cheaper. Okay. I do it because I believe this is a solution to health care, to the cost issue, and to the control issues. We want to keep control of our own health care, and this is the way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The handout that I distributed was...
You better reintroduce yourself.
Okay, it's Representative Matt Wingert again from Wilsonville. The page 2 and 3 I just printed off of the HSA Bank website describing basically how an HSA works. And I had an HSA for nearly 4 years until I came to the legislature, and then I became a public employee with the PEB. So I needed to insure my son, otherwise I would have stuck with my HSA and declined. But so as long as I was insuring him, it was automatic for me, so I just took it and I have discontinued the HSA. But I'd certainly love to have this option available so I could go back to it. In a nutshell, what I do is I pay for catastrophic insurance, and at my rather youthful age, it started out at about $114. I think I was actually at about $109 a month for my catastrophic insurance coverage. And then I had an IRS maximum. At the time, it was about 20. When I started this 4 years ago, the most I could put in as a single person was $2,500. So I opened up an HSA account, and I put $2,500 into it, and I got to take that off my taxes for putting that in. And then... basically, although the insurance did cover some my doctor checkup, if I had anything like prescription drugs or anything like that, it came out of that account. But I never really came anywhere near spending the $2,600, so it would roll over. And year after year, I put in the maximum of $2,600, it went up to $2,750. I think it's about $2,900 or I guess now it's $3,500. So I was building up money in that account and paying the catastrophic insurance. And what hit me as I was doing the HSA is I was wondering why other, especially large companies and even public employers, wouldn't offer this. I remember reading in the paper that a couple years ago there was a negotiation going at PPS between the teachers, and there was the board wanted the teachers to take on some of the costs, and part of the reason was it stated in the paper that they were up to $900 per employee per month in costs. And I just immediately, when I read that in the paper, sat down and worked that out and assumed every one of those teachers was a family plan under my LifeWise scenario, and I couldn't spend that much. I couldn't cost the Portland Public School District $900 a month per employee to fully pay for this system for the teachers. And the benefit, if they'd had it, was they would have actually had a secondary retirement account if they didn't use the full amount. So what I did on this chart was just I asked PEB for some basic numbers on how many employees they have covered and how many they actually have a bunch of categories for employee plus, but I put all the employee pluses into one because that would essentially be a family plan under HSA. So they have the 12,904 that are employee only and the 36,142 that are employee plus. And they told me the average monthly premium they budget there is a little over $1,000. So I added it up, and that's how you get your $661 million figure, roughly. And I'll fully admit that this is very, very rough, just based on my working off of what PEB told me and going to LifeWise and the HSA Bank to do the figures. But I'm just trying to give you a sense of what's possible. So we figure roughly they're spending on an annual basis about $661 million. And what I did down below here is, if the public employer, in this case the state, were to fully contribute both sides of this. So for a single public employee, you'd put $3,500, the maximum IRS amount, into their account. If it was a family plan, you'd put the $5,950 in. And then I just used LifeWise's little chart on their website about how much they would charge for catastrophic insurance. And I picked somebody I thought would be the cheapest, somebody young, and then then somebody older who would obviously be more expensive, and I did the same thing here. I actually thought an older couple, family of four, would be more expensive, but it turned out just an older couple was more expensive. So that's your highest case scenario is that $5,950 plus the 12 plus the 6,444, which comes to a total employee cost for those folks of 12,394. So they'd be on the high end. And that created my range of what at the most, every one of these employee and families was a, an older couple, then you'd have that max end. So obviously we're going to be somewhere in between. The most you could spend on that is $440 million. And so that's why at the bottom there, my rough estimate of the potential savings, and that this would be if everyone converted. Our bill just simply wants to offer the option for employees to take this. But if everyone converted, the savings to the taxpayer could be upwards of $243 million on an annual basis. And the employees would actually come out, I think, in a better position because they'd still have their health care covered. But now they're in charge of that deductible, which has been prepaid for them. And whatever they don't spend of that deductible rolls over from year to year, and they get the full deductible put into the account every year. So anyway, you can see that this kind of excites me because I think this is such a great idea, and I don't know why we wouldn't do it. And I hope the committee would consider offering this option within the Public Employees Benefits Board a scenario so that those who want to access it can. And if even 5%, 10%, 20% of them do, I believe every one of those employees that makes that option actually ends up coming out ahead, and the taxpayers benefit from every single employee that makes that decision. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just wanted to thank you all, but I just wanted to check with you. You do understand that when you as an individual set up that HSA, that's a government-sponsored plan. Some bureaucrat in Washington gave you $1,000 as a tax break to do that, and I had to pay for that.
I always appreciate the government allowing me to keep more of my own money, Representative.
So, I this is Representative Maurer, and so the tax money that I send to them is...
You help pay them.
...is a gift.
I mean, it was your...
Wrong debate, next subject.
Okay. It was your payment for living in a society.
Ah.
Okay.
Representative Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions, and they really are in the spirit of full consideration and deliberation of this interesting proposal. The first is... I truly do not know the answer to this. These high deductible health plans, are they individually underwritten? Do they consider someone's health condition? Certainly they take into account age. Can they be?
Can I answer that?
Yeah, go ahead.
It is, the answer is Yes. What he compared, Representative Wingert compared, was individual policy, which obviously they can be kicked out for pre-existing conditions. And so a group plan is always going to be a little more expensive. But even factoring that in, it would be difficult for me to expect that it's going to cost more for the exact same policy under a group plan.
Leads me to my second question, which is, what would the implication of this be? I'm going to assume that this option would be more attractive to younger, healthier people. What would that what would the implication then be for the premium cost on the group policy? The older, potentially sicker people who do not choose to take advantage of HSA, and therefore we have a group population that is not as healthy as the one that includes everybody.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, and the answer, it would have zero because it's still the same group. There, you're not separating, it's not, we're not, the group is still commingled. The experience of that group is still the 56,000 or 46,000, whatever the number is. So you're not creating an HSA group that has its own experience. Thus, you are exactly correct, thus creating a hydraulic that would raise the cost.
Well, yeah, but that's not exactly true, because if we did what was suggested, you'd be putting in the high option price into a group that was lower risk. So the next thing would be the people left in those other plans would be increasing the cost in the next year under experience rating, increasing the average cost. And if you kept taking the high amount and putting it into the lowest risk people, the other options would continue to go up. You'd end up increasing the risk, the risk composite in the options that weren't the HSAs. I mean, I could see if you could put the lowest amount in or something, then you would be taking out the low risk people, but you'd be offsetting it because you're not paying that high amount for the low risk people.
Mr. Chair, but those high risk people are in our pool today. You're not changing the demographic.
They're all in your pool
today.
But you're taking the lowest risk out of those. Let's say there are two other plans. Let's say there's one other plan. And now you have an option, a HSA option. And you predicate the amount you put into the low SA option on the premium for the one group you had. You now take half of the low option people out and the low risk people out. It doubles the price, or it increases the price of the pool that's left. And if you keep putting that amount in, if that's what you use to fund the HSA option, you continue to raise the rates because the rates are based on the fully covered option.
Mr. Chair, but nothing changes for the employee because it's all being covered.
No, it's the state.
Right.
We care about those bureaucrats.
Right. But if in
are they getting ripped off?
But again, I think you're actually paying a low. If what you're talking about is just really healthy young people moving over, then you're paying a low rate on them. You're paying the low insurance rate. So
yeah, but the proposal was to use the high rate. That's what your proposal was, right? It says in there, you take the price of the high option and you invest that in the HSA.
Well, you cover the cost of the HSA. And so what if you have a 29-year-old employee who moves over to an HSA, and therefore their total cost for catastrophic insurance is $1,452, and you're going to contribute the HSA contribution of $3,500, the total cost to PEB is $4,952 for that person.
I'm reading Mr. Petula's down in the fifth or so paragraph, the thing that says the key for Oregon is to ask for quotes and fund the AHSA with the full amount of the savings and premium between your most generous offering and the high deductible plan. So you use your most generous offering, use the high price spread to pay for the HSA under what you're proposing. But you then move the low risk people out of the most generous one. All right, then I don't understand.
Chair Greenlee, I have experience on this, and the first paragraph on the second page talks about Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, United Healthcare Association of Health Insurance Plans, and Cigna, all producing studies within the last 3 months that shows that that absolutely does not happen. For example, my wife is a juvenile diabetic. I've had a stroke, I've had two hip replacements and a knee replacement, and it's cheaper for me to be on the HSA plan than it is on a low deductible plan, because I understand this maximum out-of-pocket cost makes all the difference in the world. Once you hit that maximum out-of-pocket cost, you don't have to make co-pays for prescriptions or to see the doctor. Now, I haven't hit that every year. I try not to. I want to transfer money forward in my HSA. But if you look at the demographics, who takes the plan is equally divided between the sick and the non-sick. It's age difference doesn't make any difference.
I'll be glad to do healthcare research with you.
Yeah,
that's not the research
Mr. Chair? Yeah. If I was up next to you, I would nudge you and say, we need to move on.
We do need to move on. Representative Denbrough and then Representative Garrett, and then we'll move on.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome to come on back anytime. Representative Wingate, you're welcome to join us.
I just have a question of what exactly the measure would do. Right now, PEB could offer HSA plans, if it wanted to, and this would essentially order them to do so. Is that essentially what we're doing? So why is PEB not offering these plans now?
We're going to have a PEB witness in a moment, and that would be a good question to ask them.
Great.
Yes.
That's my impression.
Representative Garrett?
I think my issues have been addressed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm afraid I'm supposed to be in a committee myself.
Okay.
Right now.
We have now T.J. Sullivan and we have and Joan Kapowicz. Can we have you?
From PEB.
Did I say that right?
Kapowicz.
I'm sorry. I got bad advice. It's always a danger. You got to watch out the advice you get.
That's right.
Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. My name is T.J. Sullivan. I'm an insurance agent right here in Salem, just down the street. But I do have clients that extend across the state of Oregon. So health care is near and dear to me as I'm out meeting with them. And I think that as I've listened to your testimony here today, I wish I had my business cards with me so I could pass it out to all of you, especially Representative Harker. I think we should do business because, my experience with meeting...
I don't think this is an appropriate
job. But you can certainly send your business card to anybody. That's right. My experience with HSAs a lot of times is when I go out and I meet with a group, it's just like any other business model. When you're introducing a new concept to them, There's a few percent that are risk takers, and they get in and they experience the product and they find out how it works. And as they find out how HSAs work, you begin to see a migration inside of a company if they're on a dual choice plan where they offer a first dollar PPO plan, which is a benefit rich plan, and then they offer an HSA plan. A lot of times you see the risk takers or the people who take the time to educate themselves going with the HSA first, and then you begin to see a steady migration over to the health savings account plans. And a lot of times when I hear people say that HSAs are only for the healthy and the wealthy, I know I have found my target client, because this is somebody who does not understand. And if you can convince the skeptic of how these plans work, then you will have a customer for life. My wife and I have been on an HSA plan since they were first came out in 98, only they were called Archer MSAs at the time. We've had two children and a variety of illnesses in the meantime, and it has proved to be a solid insurance product for us to have. And I think not offering it as a state, to me, is like Wells Fargo getting a bailout and then sending their execs to Las Vegas to celebrate. And I think that offer...
I go to Las Vegas if I don't offer.
That's right. You can go to Grand Ron. But
well done.
The idea behind HSAs, a lot of times as I sit and talk, if I go in and I meet with a group of people, who do you think understands health insurance the best inside of any group? The healthy or the sick? Who understands how much they spend, the healthy or the sick? And a lot of times, the people who understand the true cost of health insurance are not the healthiest people in a group. It's the sickest people in the group. And when you begin to look at how much you spend on an annual basis on copays, on maximum out of pocket, on cost to add a spouse or your children to a plan, it's the people who have got the illnesses in their family that understand that the best. And a lot of times, those are the people who make the decision to move to an HSA first because of the out-of-pocket expenses and the savings that they're going to recognize by being on a health savings account. And I heard Chair Greenlick talk about what happens, is there a cost shift that takes place if you start to move the healthiest people off of the PPO plan that costs more on a monthly basis and moving them over to the HSA plan. And those folks who are on the PPO plan, the monthly premium that gets paid, it's not like they're not utilizing care. They're still utilizing care. They're still costing the insurance company something to administer all of those claims. And by putting them over on an HSA, you begin to eliminate the amount of money that they are spending that the insurance company would have paid, and instead that money's coming out of their HSA. So you lower the insurance company's administrative costs for the plan, and you also eliminate the claims that they would have normally paid for those people. And you also do migrate some people who are not healthy onto that plan, and they begin to absorb more of those costs out of their HSA. And for government, I think that this is a crucial option to at least offer. For people in my generation, Medicare is not going to exist the way it does today. This is the reason why HSAs were included in the Medicare Act. And so as a government, what you are saying is we recognize this, and we are going to give the folks that work for this state, many of whom, since I live here in Salem, I have many friends that are in my age demographic. And as I talk with them about health savings accounts, this is something that they're very much interested in. And, you know, if you took the time to poll your employees and find out what the interest was, for those of them that understand it, that have talked to me, they would have an interest in moving over to this plan because it gives them the opportunity to save for their retirement. It gives them the opportunity to manage their health care in a way that costs the state less, that costs the insurance company less, and gives them an opportunity to save for their future. And I think that this is a viable option, and I really do hope that you guys give the workers in the state of Oregon an opportunity to have this.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Mm-hmm. Questions? Thank you very much. Bring along somebody riding shotgun, you're welcome to.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Joan Kapowicz, and I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefits Board, PEB. And I will keep this very brief because you have a room full of people who I believe want to testify on some of the other bills. But in fact, the PEB board, charged by statute with designing benefit programs, did last look at a health system, an HSA, in 2004. You know, got all the information together, had a very long, protracted policy discussion about it. Their conclusion, based on the evidence from their consultants, was that this would disproportionately impact those who were sicker because, in fact, the national research, all of our research that our consultants provide with us show that it is, in fact, the younger, healthier population that tends to choose this particular product. Not to say that that's going to be across the board, but that's been the tendency. So when they show what the costs are, what they say is if about 4,000 of our employees chose this, it would cost an additional $2.5 million a year. So for that reason and some others, the board decided that they, you know, decided not to offer this particular plan type. And we do get information from our members, and they have not been overwhelming in asking for this particular type of model. But it is the kind of thing that the board periodically reviews what kind of plans to have. And I just wanted to keep it brief and let you know that history.
Are you in the midst of planning to review it again?
Chair Greenlake, don't see it on our next few months' agenda, I could certainly bring back to the board, you know, the interest in looking at it again, given that it has been a period of time since we last analyzed it.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I mean, that's an awful long time to wait to review it. In 2004, it didn't exist, and we hadn't existed, so everything was speculative. Now you have something to go against. So I would highly encourage that you relook at it. I don't understand how it can cost more if the state pays for everything today anyway. I could understand it costing more if employees had were paying deductibles today, if you know, that we paid for part of our health insurance premium. I could understand that can make a rational choice. But if the state pays my insurance premium and they pay for, there is no deductible, so that's not even on the table, I don't understand how it could cost the state more. It doesn't pass the common sense test.
It depends on, it was the point I was trying to make before, it depends on how much you take out of the other pool to fund the HSA. If you take a relatively small amount out of the pool to fund the HSS, then the offset of changing the risk of the ones who are left can be offset. But if you funded it, as the testimony was, by taking the highest price spread and putting that much money into the HSA, that has a tendency to raise the price of the highest priced option. So, I mean, it really depends on how much you put into the HSA.
And Mr. Chair, I would disagree, because we are, for an individual in the state of Oregon, for under PEB, we're spending over $8,000 a year for medical insurance. Yes, we are.
Yeah, no, all right.
Okay. And so to the insurance company, they say, write me a check for $8,000 this year, and we'll cover one individual times a whole lot of people. They don't care whether that is through a whether it's a deductible. How did
they get that $8,000 price is the question. They got to take $8,000 price by taking last year's experience. I mean, it didn't come out of the air. Those are experience-rated plans.
We need to.
Let you and I have this conversation. Did you get your answer?
Well, actually, I have a further question.
Go for it.
Thank you,
Representative Garrett.
Great. So most of the people in the PEB plan are in represented bargaining units, right?
Chair Greenleaf, that's correct.
And so are you hearing about this from them? Are the unions bringing it up as something they'd like for their members?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Demro, this has not been one of the things that's come up. I've only been with PEB for a year, but it has not come up. It hasn't really raised other than an occasional request when we survey our members. You'll occasionally get free-form comments. You know, I'm interested in an HSA, but it hasn't risen to the driving need for.
Okay, thanks.
Done?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Garrett? Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, you have another question?
No.
Oh, that's it. You got it.
Yes, sir.
Representative Harper.
For those of you who have been with us for a while.
I had a continuing saga.
If we were to, thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were to pass this bill and require PEB to offer HSA options, when would that become available?
Yeah, what's your contract cycle, I guess, is the question.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Harker, we estimated that to do something like this, to get it started, would take at least 9 months in terms of developing a request for proposal with certain specifics, because these are pretty complicated tools, for lack of a better way, in terms of how you would have to manage it. We are on an annual contract cycle, so I would estimate it would at least be probably a year and a half or so out, given that we haven't started yet, kind of thing, between you.
Could I ask if you could check back in with your board as soon as you can and see whether they would be interested in exploring it and seeing what the consequences are? I think the kind of answer you got last time, if it comes out the same.
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick, I would be happy to bring it to the board at our next meeting.
Thank you.
Representative Kotex is mighty quiet.
Okay.
I think an update of the analysis is in order. I mean, it's been 5 years.
It's been five years.
That's appropriate. But again, I have to support what Joan is saying. We're not hearing. They survey PEB members ad infinitum, okay? And but maybe there needs to be a groundswell. But what I will say is what I've noticed from being on the board, and I've only been on a short time. They work very hard to manage costs and try new things in a way that does promote better health and better use of the healthcare system and manage the costs of the plans. And the only concern I would have is reducing their ability to do what they have been doing, which is to manage the premium costs, to have better health outcomes. They're talking about moving to a self-insured plan. I don't know what the analysis will show, but I think there's a risk of undermining the ability of PEB to manage a large pool in a very effective way if we start siphoning off healthier folks potentially. So that just would be my concern. But again, I think an analysis would make some sense. And we haven't done it in 5 years, so.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll close the public hearing on HB 2464 and open a public hearing on HB 2465. You want to kick this one off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can do it from here.
I will. House Bill 2465 would permit the deduction of health insurance premiums from an individual state tax return. Currently, health insurance is deductible if you are a business. It is deductible if you are self-employed, but not if you are unemployed in between jobs. You cannot go out and purchase health insurance and have a deductible. Now, we clearly cannot affect the federal tax rolls, but we can affect the state income tax code. And there would be a fiscal, based on the language of the bill today, and that can be an issue, clearly, can be an issue. But we also have 600,000 uninsured Oregonians. And anything we do to encourage or to incentivize Oregonians to purchase health insurance, I think would be a good thing. And in fact, I believe if we can incentivize people through income taxes, that in fact we're, as a state, getting off cheap. And I would ask the chair to encourage legislative fiscal to do an analysis of this, because
it'd be revenue, I think.
It's revenue. Excuse me. To ask this simple question, given their workload and try not to overburden them, but I think this is actually a very fair question. I think the only thing that the hugest assumption in this whole conversation is, quite frankly, who's going to take advantage of it? And I don't know. I honestly do not know the answer to that question.
I think we have a subsequent to revenue.
Yes, we do.
So
yes.
We might want to deal with some issues here and then send it on to them. We should check in with LRO.
In order, we are supposed to have a...
Correct.
We couldn't pass it out of committee without a revenue.
We need okay. What would be called a revenue light.
Okay, great.
So I will end it there.
Thank you.
But we need to move on because the largest conversation really is our next bill.
Okay, and let's start with an honored alum. Again, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tootie Smith. Today I'm representing Oregon Family Council, and we have come in support of House Bill 2465. We think it makes a big deal to families in these economic times. A lot of people are out of jobs, losing their benefits, and some people, even though they're out of jobs, still would like to maintain their health insurance for obvious reasons for their families. According to our numbers, about 5% of Oregonians pay for their own health insurance, and it's about 250,000 people. And that comes from the state health office. It doesn't seem like a large amount of people, but you're helping families. This legislature is in a tough position. You're going to be cutting programs, social programs. I think, like you say, legislative light is in order for this. I think you can do a lot of good with very little money. This bill will provide extra dollars to families in need to continue their health insurance. This is at a time when employers are passing more costs on to their employees. For healthy individuals, choosing their own plan might be more affordable, especially if there's a tax benefit involved. Many in this building and across the state are looking for a statewide health care or a national health care program, but this is not going to happen immediately. In a state the size of Oregon without a major, my opinion, without a major influx of federal dollars, it's going to be very difficult. And this is just one way, I think, to take control of your own, and those people who can pay on their own get a tax break. It's likely that the hard economic times will continue past 2009, and this will allow families to continue coverage that might otherwise be neglected in favor of more pressing needs like food, clothing, and housing. We should reward those who've taken the initiative to provide for their needs and those of their family, and therefore reducing the burden on others. And that's really all I have to say today. We really encourage that, you folks take a real good close look at this. I know there's many, many pressing problems, and you have a lot to bear this session, and I feel for that. Oregon Family Council represents over 2,000 churches across the state of Oregon, and I'm happy to say we're celebrating our 30th anniversary in existence. So thank you very much.
Any questions? I do want to point out one of the items that we suggest in 2009 to be considered in an exchange is the extent to which we could create so-called 125 programs.
Right.
Which would allow people essentially to do this with pre-tax, pre-state and federal tax dollars. So, I mean, this is something we need to be paying attention to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jason Berruti and Tim Lehman, please. And could we keep it relatively short? We have another bill to be hearing as well. And I try hard to get everybody out of here by 5.
Sorry. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, committee. My name is Jason Berruti. I'm an insurance agent here in Salem, and also have kind of a personal touch to this bill. Typically, right now, what happens is employers pay the premium for employees. We do that at our firm. The employees then have to pay to cover spouses or kids or whatever. So our office gets a lot of calls for people that are wanting to buy individual policies. So as Representative Maurer said, if they do that right now, they get no deduction on that, or they're doing that because the family premium at the company is too expensive, but also the individual premium is very expensive as well. So my standpoint on it is that anything we can do to help that cost with a tax break would be very, very beneficial. In my own instance, the roughly $3,000 a year I pay for my own personal health insurance through my company, our employer-based plan, I get to deduct that. The almost $4,500 a year that I pay to cover my wife and kids through a Regents individual plan, I don't get a deduction for that. And I've always thought that was a little bit odd about how that worked, where I was doing my part, having coverage, but not getting a deduction for it. The other piece, as you spoke to our group yesterday, Chair Greenlick, about cost shifting and that sort of thing, anything we can do to get more people covered under the plan, under commercial plans, helps with cost shifting and gets people covered at a commercial rate and gets physicians paid at those rates as well. So I just would like to say I'm very supportive of this issue.
You have a small business, is it? Are you a small business? Or an employee?
We have about 200 employees at our company. Yeah.
Oh, but it isn't your own company. And I was asking why you don't buy the coverage for everybody and offset it with wages or something.
Well, we do. I mean, we pay. I'm a partner in the entity, so I essentially have to pay my own premiums. But we do have a plan that, an employer-based plan, but the individual plans. Are you talking about why I do that for my own wife? And
well, I was talking about why you don't offer an employee-based plan that includes your wife and kids and offset it with income, reducing income tax. And that,
well,
then it would be with pre-tax dollars.
We do, but if you do the difference between what I would pay for my employer-based plan with a tax deduction is still significantly higher than what I would pay in the individual market. The premium, the premium that my employer pays would cost me like $700 a month to cover them. It costs me $350 to cover my kids through an individual plan. Even though I don't get a tax deduction for it, it's less money.
Okay, great. Are there any questions? Yes, Mr. Lyman.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Tim Lyman, and I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm a self-employed business person, a real estate broker. So right now that's a very small business. Representative Maurer, you, either you're mistaken or I'm due a huge refund here, because I don't believe that the money that I pay for my health insurance is deductible, at least not according to the tax software I plug it into every year.
As a business expense?
As a business expense, if you're self-employed, yes.
Yes.
Federally.
All right.
That was changed back in 2005. Maybe.
Okay, well, it looks like the state's going to get some amended returns from
that. Gradually it went in.
Check with somebody who knows insurance law better than this guy.
Well,
and that's worth what you're paying for it.
I do pay taxes, and I have not always been a state employee.
And you're a small businessman.
Well, I have not been deducting it, and if it is in fact the case that... as I believe that I can't deduct it, although I may be incorrect. I think the strength of this bill is it allows small business people to keep more of their own money. You know, we're literally 120 days away from bankruptcy all the time. It's just the way we live. If our businesses fail, we usually wind up being completely wiped out in bankruptcy because by the time they fail, generally we've refinanced the house, maxed out every single credit card, and borrowed from every relative we can name. So anything that allows us to keep more money is very important to us. Now, I know that now to you folks dealing with dollars in the millions and billions, it might seem that this amount of money would be a very small amount. But I can tell you precisely, assuming that I can't deduct this, precisely what it would mean to me, and that is 2,000 flyers, 25,000 business cards, several cable TV ads, postage for 1,000 mailings, enough gas to show 500 homes, a month of low-rotation radio advertising. Now, I know from past experience that each one of those activities should net me about 4 sales. My projections for this year is that it's going to net me about 1.5 sales. Okay, even if that were only one sale, the amount of the state's tax receipt on that sale would more than double what it would lose through that deduction. That's it.
Okay. I would like to say we're in hard budgeting times and we're looking at terrible cuts, but I think most of us really recognize there are human faces behind all the things we're doing, including in this one. So the fact that we deal with millions doesn't mean it's not important to us or individuals to be protected as well as we can. We don't lose face of that. So that's why we're happy that you're here to testify to remind
us.
Well,
I may be happy. I may get to file some amended returns here.
He gets 10%.
If your self-employment income is from a Schedule C business and you report a net loss on the 1040, you know, you're not eligible. It says if you have self-employment income, then you can take a deduction for health insurance expenses.
And premiums are close.
You need a new tax lawyer, I think.
I need new tax software as well.
Representative Harker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are you going to give some tax advice, too?
No, just to remind people out there that the people up here, we do have some benefits from being in the state. But we also, several of us, run businesses. We're in the same position as you. It's not that wide a gulf. We do here talk about cutting millions, yay, billions. But in real life, we're dealing with the same issues you are. So.
Thank you. Okay, thank you both very much. Can we have Tom Harrison and T.J. Sullivan again?
Yeah, exactly.
You're bold. It was soothing.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, do we have anyone from revenue here?
No, we don't.
I'm trying to avoid any real information.
Do I have to admit that?
I'm just curious what the history of, you know, Oregon has, you know, lots of deductions, so it strikes me as interesting that we don't have this one. But then it makes me think about...
If we're 65, we do.
Oh, over 65?
Yeah, yeah. If you're over 65, you... Oh, is it over 65?
Yeah.
You get to deduct any any medical expense.
Is that what it is?
One to one. Well, that is a tax credit.
Mr. Chair, yeah, if you're 62 in Oregon, you can deduct from zero or the first dollar to 7.5% of your income. It's not a credit; it's a deduction.
Of your
adjusted income, and then over 7.5%, the federal takes care of that. So effectively, if you're over 62, and you have income to offset it, you can get 100% of your health care paid for.
I know we're discussing
not paid for. You get
well, you get 9%. Yeah, you're right. Because it's not a dollar for dollar. Yeah.
Well, no, because I'm sitting over here mulling over our premium assistance program while we're talking about this. But that's a different discussion.
Okay. And I do apologize because we have another committee and some people have traveled an awful long ways.
Go for it.
I'll go first. Thank you. My name is TJ Sullivan. I'm an agent here in Salem, Oregon. And I do appreciate the time to testify in front of you. I would say that also I'm a member of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, and members of our association have been in past sessions to discuss bills that were being pursued in this body, and we have testified about the detrimental effect that it would have both on the cost of coverage and on reducing coverage options for people in this state. And I will tell you that in very few instances have we been listened to. And I will tell you that you guys could take testimony from now through the end of this year from people about health insurance, and you still would not come close to talking to the number of people that we do about health insurance on a daily basis. And a lot of times when the bills get passed here and the impact is exactly what we said it would be, detrimental, and there's a cost increase, we're the ones on the front lines that have to go out and meet with people and watch the employer say, it's time to give this up. I'm going to start sticking the money in people's paychecks that I was spending on health insurance, and they can go out and find it on their own. And that's becoming an all too frequent reality in my world. And it would be nice for me to be able to go and have some good news for a change, to say that your legislature did this for you, and this is going to help you with the cost of health insurance. To vote against this is to vote against health care affordability. It really is. There's no other way for me to frame it. And specifically, this would really help people that are having to enroll in OMIP, which is Oregon's Guarantee Issue Plan, which is the highest individual cost plan that you can find out there. And so, you know, really you would be helping probably the most vulnerable people. The people that lose their group health plans, I would say, are Oregon's working poor, which as I meet with people, that's the largest percentage of people I think in this state that need help with health insurance. They may not be the most destitute. I'm saying it's the largest percentage of people in this state that need help with health insurance is the working poor. And this bill really gets to the heart of that matter. I know that it would result in less revenue for the state. And if you just look at it from a revenue standpoint, then you're missing the big picture, because it's also going to reduce the amount in the cost shift that exists, and that will enable more people to get on health insurance, which would backfill some state dollars by having to provide less assistance to individuals in need in this state. And so I understand the economic crunch we're in. I'm a city councilor for the city of Salem. We're in the same economic pinch, albeit on a smaller scale, so I empathize with you guys. But sometimes, as a business person, you spend money to make money, or you spend money to save money.
This isn't very valuable to the working poor, though. It's a tax deduction.
This is extremely valuable to the working poor.
They mostly don't pay much in the way of state taxes.
No. People who are destitute don't pay much in the way of state taxes. People who are in that 25 to 50,000 pay range, those people do pay taxes.
That's the working poor?
That's the working poor.
Okay. Thank you. Do you want a brief comment on the next bill you listed again?
BBB.
The OIB.
Yes, and briefly, my comment is we've heard from around the state from different school boards that their premiums have gone up dramatically from what they would pay, that their customer service has gone down from what they've experienced, and that local economies have suffered by not keeping those dollars local. And so I would just encourage you to reconsider or to consider this bill and to give localities the opportunity to pull out of the bigger program.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you.
Mr. Harrison.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Tom Harrison. I am a resident of Oregon City, a small businessman, and a lifelong Oregon resident. I'm a native son of Oregon. After college, I began my professional life as an employee, but for the last 30 years, I've operated my own business, sometimes alone, sometimes with partners, sometimes with employees, and sometimes, like now, without. I want to see Oregon and Oregon's citizens prosper, and that requires not only a healthy climate for the risk takers that invest time and money into businesses that create jobs, but also a healthy climate for the people who need jobs. For decades, employers have been able to offer health benefits to their employees as a tax-deductible business expense, without that benefit being considered taxable income to the employee. Through the tax code, the federal government was encouraging employers to provide health benefits. But times change, and we need more options. The business world is more dynamic than ever in history. People change jobs more frequently, or start small businesses, or close them and again become employees. And healthcare costs have become a much more significant part of our budgets as the technology to live longer gets better and better. In the marketplace, we all recognize that more options are good for the consumer because more varieties and sources of products allow better fits to the consumer's needs and allow them to make more focused purchases. In the job market, more options for the employer and the employee allow better job fits and more flexibility to adapt to a changing world, and that means more productivity.
What'd you call it?
For the new entrepreneur, more options means an easier transition from employee to employer. With House Bill 2465, Oregon has a chance to widen the options for the employer-employee market as well as for the entrepreneur. By leveling the playing field for the employee and the employer, allowing either to deduct the cost of health benefits, you take away no options, but reduce the stress on both by giving each more freedom to make a best-fit decision. And can you imagine how many people in Oregon will discover that with health benefit costs deductible for the individual, they can now justify taking the plunge of their own entrepreneurial venture? The economy has been shedding jobs, and businesses have been downsizing or closing altogether. I submit to you that House Bill 2465 represents one way to encourage growth and productivity by making it easier to be an employee in Oregon and easier to be an employer or entrepreneur. That's good for Oregon citizens, and that means it's good for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this panel? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 2465 and open public hearing on House Bill 2455. And I'll ask Representative Maurer to make a brief opening statement.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's no secret that I oppose the House Bill 4, or Senate Bill 426, excuse me, from last session about the consolidation of school districts into the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and worked very hard to ensure that my local school district, Grants Pass School District Number 7, would not be pulled in, and actually was successful. I think the jury is still out as to whether OEB is going to work, and we still have a number of years before that all plays out. But in the meantime, there have been winners and there have been losers in the OEB conversation. And it pains me that we have losers in this process, because if it was worked right, there would be no losers. There, I believe, testimony from districts that were able to stay out of it, who it would have cost employees money, and had no impact on the district, but would have cost the employees at the district substantially. So I'm going to let it to the testifiers to tell their stories, and actually, I guess we're going to hear both sides, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So look forward to it.
Okay. I have two people listed as being from 100 miles away. Is that correct? Brett Yancey, are you?
I'm not a
Okay, yeah. Great. Things got a little mixed
one
up.
One of my constituents.
Yeah, there is someone. Let me call up the three school district representatives. Dan Huber, Cantola, Deborah Johnson, and Leanne McIvan. Is that right?
McIrvin.
Oh, well. Two out of three is not bad. Why don't you all come on up? We're going to have Representative Chris Edwards is going to be here in a minute who wants to help supplement some of this testimony and ask him to do it from ideas. Y'all go for it.
All right.
Oh, go ahead.
Is that okay?
Yes, please.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I am Representative Mallard's other school district, superintendent of Three Rivers Schools, and Representative Parker, Chairman Greenlick, appreciate the response that you had about caring for the people. And so, really, I'm here to represent not only my district, but 400 employees. And so,
please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dan Huber Cantola, Superintendent, Three Rivers School District. And I want to talk about my 400 employees real quick. Apologize, but education, you got to have something to look at. So here we go. We do have 400 employees that we're talking about. We have four employee groups, like every other school district. And each one of those employee groups has an insurance committee. We're not opposed to OEBB. I want that known for the record. Rather, we support any effort to keep good, affordable health care available to our employees and their families. With that, they still have in their plans, our teacher group may switch to OEBB this year, even though they're not required to switch at this time because our teachers have slightly different plans. Some of our employee groups, however, have made some significant cost-saving adjustments to their plans. Covered services have been adjusted, deductibles have been adjusted, prescription drug plans have been adjusted, copays for doctor visits have been adjusted, copays for prescription drugs have been adjusted. We've adjusted the list of preferred drugs. And I want to point out that those changes were not made by the school district, but those changes were made by mainly the classified employee group, which represents the custodians, the cooks, the people that serve the students in our district. And they made those choices so that they could continue to offer health care to their employee groups. We have many people in that employee group that are not full-time, so we don't cover all of their health care. So they pay not only above what our cap is, but they pay a percentage of the premium beyond that. So they've worked very hard to try to keep the cost low, but still provide a good plan. When we looked at OEBB, they offered comparable plans. In fact, some of the plans were simply superior to our current plan. We have one employee group that has not made the adjustments. That's the teacher group. When this group is factored into our whole district, it does make our whole district comparable to the OEBB plan. However, our classified plan, administrative plan, and confidential plans are not comparable. When you look at the prices, we negotiated this year a 12-month deal with Pacific Source for an $850 plan, which also met our cap. If we look at the most comparable plan for OEBB, that plan would have cost us $1,370 a month. If you do the math, even though we're a small school district of only 5,000 kids, it would have cost our 400 employees $737,000 for insurance above what they could have gotten through Pacific Source. So we're not opposed to OEBB. We would just like the opportunity to continue to allow our people to manage their own health care plans, make it affordable.
Mr. Cantola, that $737,000 figure was not an additional cost to the district. This was going to be directly passed on to the employees that would have come out of, directly out of their paycheck, correct?
That is true. Our cap for all those groups is $850, so they would have had to have paid this difference out of their paychecks.
If you had put all the groups in, the average cost would have been the same as before?
Say that again?
If you had put all of your groups in, as this was intended to be, I think, to create an average across all groups, if you had put all of your three or four, I'm not sure which way, groups in, would that have made the cost afterwards the same as before?
To the district?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can answer that, because it's more complicated than that. Our teacher group, each group has a committee that looks at the benefits. Our teacher group has decided, essentially, they didn't want to make any changes to a plan that existed back in a thing called Greater Oregon Health Plan. It's got some oddities to it, and they didn't want to make any prescription drug changes. They didn't want to do anything to the plan. They've got a deductible that's lower than the classified group does and that kind of stuff. If you kept their plan as is and factored that in with the other group, yeah, we'd be comparable to the $1,003 figure. Am I answering that question correctly?
No, you're answering it very correctly. I mean, the notion was these things were supposed to average out to be the same. There's no question if you allowed every district to take only the high-risk folks and put them into OWEB and leave the low-risk folks out, the residual are going to certainly be cheaper.
And that would be true, but that's not what we did.
So the classified employees are now high-risk and the teachers are low-risk?
No, it's the opposite.
Our class
risk went into OWEB, leaving the low risk in their existing market.
There's no risk.
No,
this is
actually
about a bargaining unit.
There's a range in each one of the bargaining units. There would be high risk people in the teachers group and low risk people in the teachers group. High risk in the classified, low risk. I mean, they range in age from brand new employees to they're ready to retire in the classified ranks.
Sorry, I think I shouldn't be interrupting. Me too.
That's okay. It's really about the choices they made in their plan so that they could keep it affordable to their membership. There are people that work four-hour jobs a day, and really the only reason that they work is to pay the insurance for their family. And they've chosen to have higher deductibles. They've chosen to have some higher copays. They've chosen to have fewer drugs on the preferred drug list. By choice, to keep it so that the vast majority of their membership can have an affordable health care plan. And I'm just asking on their behalf, please continue to allow them to have that option.
Thank you. Let's get all three and then we'll get questions.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. My name is Leanne McIrvin, and I'm here today representing the Bethel School District in Eugene in support of House Bill 2455. I am the chair of the District Joint Insurance Benefits Committee, and this is a collaborative committee that has been in existence for 20 years, comprising teachers, administrators, and retirees. And in the past 20 years, we have been in charge of developing, purchasing, implementing, and maintaining a comprehensive benefits plan. And throughout those 20 years, we have been able to maintain a very comprehensive high level of benefits while experiencing year after year premium rates that are consistently below trend. And along that line then, for 2008 and 2009, our medical, vision, and prescription rate with our current carrier, which is also Pacific Source, would have been $862 a month as compared to the comparable OEB plan, which would have a rate of $1,026 per month per employee or per subscriber. So if Bethel had been required to enter OEB in the fall, then the impact to the district would have been a total of $823,176. And yes, as you just addressed, that probably at this point would have been passed on to the subscribers, which for an individual teacher would have meant an increase of over $164 per month. For the retirees, it would have been an even a greater increase per month. I think for obvious reasons, we are opposed to penalizing groups, school districts, employee groups, for managing their benefits well and saving money. It is certainly in our best interest to try to save the monies as best we can and put them to use in educating children. So we would really like you to consider, and we urge you to establish conditions which will allow us to continue to save those monies for our school district. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick. My name for the record is Debbie Johnson, RN. I'm the health resource coordinator for Beaverton School District, your district.
I did. One of my three.
That's right. And Representative Harker's as well. I had the privilege. I have two documents in front of you. One is dated January 21st, 2009. I had the privilege of testifying before the Senate Education Committee, who's also chaired by a Beaverton representative, Senator Haas. In addition, I've also provided all of you with the Beaverton School District. This is our first-tier legislative agenda. As you can see on our agenda, number one, and I know, Representative Harker, you are aware of this, our district, this comes from the board. This comes from the top, the superintendent, senior administration, all the way down. We want opt-out, and it's very clear in all our documents what we want. What kind of impact does OIB have on Beaverton School District? We currently, this school year, pay $40.9 million in premium to our health care carriers, Regents, Kaiser, Willamette Dental. If we had entered OIB, we were not subject until this coming year in 2009. But if we had, we did a side-by-side comparison if you flip your paper over, and we would have paid $49.5 million to OEB with comparable plans. During OEB was present, at my my testimony on the 21st, and we have been told in the past that our numbers were inflated by people outside of our district. But at that point, Steve McNanny, the chair, said that Debbie's numbers are good. So that is on the record. So we will stand by our numbers that OEB is 21% higher this year than Beaverton's plan. This does not include our retirees. If you look at our sheet about what we want this legislative session, above that is our estimated impact. Our retirees would have suffered between $600 to $2,400 more in premium per year if we had gone into OEB. What do we want? We want opt-out for districts that can demonstrate their costs below OEB's for comparable plans. Our CFO has asked that I pass on to all of you, like I did to the Senate committee, in these times, and Friday we're going to hear more bad news, we're already $18 million that we have to recover between now and June 30. We know Friday may be worse. It is not fiscally prudent to have her budget close to $9 million for potential increased cost annually. And I know our other districts agree with that, trying to budget that as a potential going in and undergo these annual comparability analysis, which is in the statute. And we have to abide by that. You have to go in. You have to be compared. We're going through that comparability analysis now with OEB. They are waiting for our rates. We will get our rates later this month, first part of March. We will submit that to OEB. More than likely, we're hearing the buzz. We may get a waiver. But remember, there's nothing in the statute, and this is what our council has advised us. There's nothing in the statute to mandate that they give us a waiver or any district a waiver each year. And it's ridiculous for us to have to do this comparison and waste taxpayer dollar and money working on this every year. So that's why we bring this to you, especially given these economic times, that this is very important to us. Unfortunately, the governor's office has already spoken to our district and has said that the governor will not hear anything about an opt-in, opt-out program. We're not looking for opt-in or opt-out. We want to stay out, and that's what we would like to do because we can consistently show for 25 years that we have been below OSBA plans, which is also a voluntary pool that was in the state until recently, and we're consistently now under OEB's for the 5 months that they've been in place. Remember that OLEB is still in its infancy. It is still an experiment at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
One question. Would your districts go in, I mean, gladly go into OLEB if it was less expensive?
Yes, if it was less expensive.
Or the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, depends. If it's exactly the same, I don't know. But I can't speak for the district on that.
Bethel?
I mean, it, obviously, if it was less money, that would be a given probably to go in. But I think there are benefit differences also for us that we have to look at. So if it's the same, if you're asking me if they're the same, cost-wise, they're not the same benefit-wise, and that would be of importance to us.
We would go in.
You did, in part.
Well, not yet.
The teachers, you said, were.
No, they have not yet. Their contract's not up, but it's likely that they will.
Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Representative, would you want to make a brief comment?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to next call Joan Kapowicz and Brett Yancey. Doug Barber, if it's consistent with the other two. If not, Doug has to wait. Representative Edwards, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state representative in House District 14, which represents West Eugene, Santa Clara, and Junction City. The Bethel School District resides entirely within my district. I'm not going to belabor this. I just simply wanted it on the record with the members of the committee and the chair and all those interested in this issue that I am working on this on behalf of my constituents in the Bethel School District as well, trying to come up with a solution for them. My staff has been actively engaged in discussions not only with other legislators that are interested in this, but with the governor's office and OLEB, trying to come up with a solution for the Bethel School District, because the bottom line is it's just going to plain old cost them more money. And I don't have a problem with the principle of OLEB. I've supported the principle of having this statewide pool in the past and think that it's a good thing, especially if it's saving the state money. But at the local level, in my local district, it's not saving them money. And if they're forced in, it is, in fact, going to cost them a good chunk of change. It would have been over $800,000 this last year. If they're forced in this next year with the escalation in health insurance costs, I don't know where that number will be, but I don't think it's out of the question to say it's going to be around $1 million. So I'm working on this issue. I think that, you know, especially given these budgetary times, and we've all had a presentation on the current budget situation, perhaps it is prudent now more than ever for our principal, upon which many folks that are opposed to opt-outs, that principal yield to just a wee bit of pragmatism and we do what's right for our local districts and help save them some money, because we know what the budgets look like. So that sums up my sentiment and testimony, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity.
Anybody want to harass this colleague?
We have ample opportunity.
Okay, we can do it some other time.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Representative Edwards. Go for it.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joan Kapowicz, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. We call it OLEB. And I'm just going to really briefly touch on a few points, and then I'm going to let Brett Yancey, our vice chair, address some of the issues brought up today. But as you're aware, OEB was passed into law in 2007, thought that they would come in over a three-year period with about 50,000 covered lives per year. Turned out we were a lot more popular than we expected to be, and we have 146,000 covered lives. In terms of the savings to the state, our actuary estimates that we have saved on about 50,000 lives, employee lives is how they were evaluating it, $36.5 million, which is higher in terms of a percent than originally was estimated on the full population. So we feel that we have met the savings goals. We've provided comparable plans. We're covering a lot more lives. And because we covered more lives, we're able to generate more administrative income, which we will now adjust. But we were able to pay back the $4.99 million in general fund that was given to us as a startup 2 years early. And in these tight budget times, that's obviously a real help. We're moving into optional benefits this year in October, and we think that will save about $1 million for districts and employees, and then long-term care next year. We do have a comparability evaluation, so that if your district feels you have comparable or you're not comparable in terms of savings, we evaluate the savings on a district basis. We did that for Bethel. Bethel District was not comparable, so we said, okay, you're not comparable. We'll look at you again next year. But in fact, Bethel did send their teachers group, I believe in? No? Classified, sorry. Got it wrong. Classified group did come in. So we will be discussing, that has been our the board's policy, and we will be talking with the board next week about putting that in administrative rule. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Brett Yancey, if I may.
Thank you. Chair Greenlech, members of the committee, my name is Brett Yancey. I'm the vice chair of the Oregon Educators Benefits Board. I serve as one member representing management. I am the director of business operations for the Springfield Public Schools, and this is obviously of great importance and to not only my district but to all districts. I would just like to start by giving a brief history. I actually testified in opposition of Senate Bill 426 more than once, and the reason that I testified in opposition was because I was against loss of local control. Once the Senate bill was passed into law, I did apply and was selected to be on the board, and quite frankly, I'm very, very happy that I did that, because I've learned a great deal over this past year and a half about not only insurance, but about the benefits of purchasing insurance in such a large pool. We are a district that is on a direct contract. We are not a member of OEB. We are not required to go into OEB until 2010. And similar to what you heard from other districts that testified today, my first obligation is to my district. It's to my district to save as much money as I can to assure that money is spent in the classrooms. And so we do look at this. We look at OEB from a consumer standpoint. We look at comparability, both comparability of plans and comparability of cost. And to date, we are not comparable to OEB. We actually are cheaper than OEB. Therefore, we are opting to stay out of OEB. If we were to become comparable as far as cost and benefits, we would opt into OEB. And I think that's important for me to state and to recognize. I would like to just make sure that the committee is aware that the board, at an earlier board meeting, did put into policy the protection of comparability with a goal of realizing that more dollars would end up in the classroom. And so some of the challenges that you've heard today, the board has actually passed into policy, and we're moving that towards permanent rule. While it's not addressed in the law, the board is taking that issue up because we recognize and value the same issues that you heard from some of my colleagues today. So if there's any questions or anything you have from either Joan or myself, I'd be happy to answer them. And thank you for the opportunity.
Well, let me ask a question. So my question, my understanding is by 2012, and it's been a long time since I've read the law, that all districts, there's no opt-out. After 2012, you're in.
The date is 2010, and the law.
Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. And the law is silent on it. The law does not address it.
Does it address what?
It does not address and require districts to
It does not require districts to enter. It is actually silent on requiring districts to enter into OEB. It does talk about comparability, comparability of costs and comparability of plan, but there are not mechanisms that say you have to go in. And the board has looked at this a great deal.
But what did you say you were changing policies now that you're going to put administrative rule?
We took policy. We have passed policy to allow districts that can prove comparability or lack of comparability out of OEB.
And you're going to put that in administrative rule?
We are moving that towards permanent rule. And we're actually talking about that next board meeting.
So there's... Then there's no need for the law, for the bill, because every district is going to be able to opt out. Well, not every district. Once you're in, you're in.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Now, once you're in, like our district, we have our own experience. We can prove, and we have insurance committees similar to these others, and we very much manage our experience. We look at claims on a monthly basis. We make choices on our benefit plans to make sure that we're competitive, and obviously we're looking at the employee. We have caps, so we're looking at employee out-of-pockets. But the issue is once you're in OEB, you're exactly right. Once you're in OEB, you're in.
So you are guaranteeing me that Beaverton School District, as an example, if they can show that they're cheaper, will never have to go into OEB.
It's the intent of the board, speaking on behalf of the board, it's the intent of the board that we want to provide the Beaverton School District or any other school district in the state, for that matter, the most affordable benefits available as long as they are comparable to what OEB is offering based on plan and on price.
And you're saying that's going to become a permanent rule?
We are moving towards permanent rule on that. We're taking it up to the next meeting,
week.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But once the districts are in, then there's no way to do a comparability to
that
get
is,
out.
That is correct.
You're okay.
That is correct.
I do have a
Denver. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you still going? Go.
I still have.
Keep going.
May I? Like,
yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Keep going.
146,000 lives in the pool now, and bigger's better.
Yeah, well, it's economies of scale.
Okay, so is that a general rule for health insurance pools? Bigger is better. And so 2 times or 10 times is going to be better than where we are today.
Chair Greenleck, Rep. Maurer, there are economies of scale. However, there is a point at which those are going to diminish. We don't believe we've quite reached that yet, but we do believe we have a very sizable pool, and it has brought us a great deal of, in terms of benefits of size and cost. We were able to negotiate a 3-year guaranteed admin rate through these contracts with our carriers, which we're not aware of any other group ever getting that kind of a guarantee.
Okay. And what is that limit? I mean, where do you reach that threshold where bigger's not any, I mean, it doesn't hurt you, it's just not better.
Chair Greenleck, Rep. Maurer, I would like to defer to our consultant. I can look into that. I've seen rough figures, but I'd prefer to give you
a
firm number.
A million?
We're going to get a million. I
believe what I've seen is more in the 200,000 to 300,000.
Okay. And last question, I promise. Do you have HSAs in your comparability panel? Are they available under OEB?
I believe we have Plan 7, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. Senator Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then Representative Harker.
I have a couple of questions. The first is just a clarifying one. You mentioned the date 2010. Mm-hmm. So what exactly happens in 2010?
By 2010, what is in the Senate bill, as I read it, is that all districts, based on their, there's collective bargaining dates that trigger that. Based on their collective bargaining dates, 2010 is the date at which all districts were to, if there is not comparability, were to have entered OEB.
Okay, so by 2010, they'll have to demonstrate comparability to stay out then.
Correct.
Okay. And the second is we heard about the problem of having to show comparability every year, the burden of that. So is that something that the board perhaps could think about relaxing? I mean, would every 2 or 3 years, would that be workable?
Chair Greenleck, Rep. Denbrough, we have looked to the law, the statute, Department of Justice, and we don't see an opportunity for us to look at a different rate than annually, and in terms of being able to track the information year after year, it's just easier to do it every year. When you get your rates, send your rates to us. We'll do the comparability evaluation, and if you're in, you know, if you're comparable, if you're not comparable, stay out. We'll see you again next year. It shouldn't be that difficult once you have the rate to send it to us in the format.
Thank you. Representative Harker?
Representative Dembrough's, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dembrough's second question was my first question, but I see heads shaking in the back of the room there, thinking that even that I'm putting words in their mouths, but that it would be really nice to get out of that annual reporting somehow, particularly since I think they anticipate that it would show year after year that they were still in a better position without participating in OEB. Is there no way that we can think of to make that unnecessary or have a rolling average or something like that, as has been suggested by Beaverton and I think others?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Harper, we could look at it again, but in our past recent looks at it, we saw that it's annual. It's pretty clear that it's an annual evaluation. We've tried to streamline it as much as possible, so all the groups have to do is send us their groups. The rates fit into a calculation. It shouldn't be too terribly laborious, but mm-hmm. we will revisit it again. We'll look at it.
Does that comparability analysis take into consideration age distribution of the group, gender, the nature of the work of the group?
Chair Greenlick, it does not.
So that if a school district had a group that was everybody in it was between 25 and 35, and your average mix was something different than that, that wouldn't be accounted for in the comparability analysis?
Chair Greenlick, no. The comparability analysis is on the design of the plans offered, so they're comparable, and on the cost of the plans and making sure that they're comparable.
Not on the risk profile.
Not on the risk profile.
Is that a rule or in the statute?
It's in statute.
Yes, ma'am.
On the annual reporting issue, would it be the thought of the board or at least the staff that you change annually, and so is that the reason for the annual reporting? I mean, I think it's, you know, if you go out 2-3 years, I think OEB as a pool will be changing every year, and so it makes sense to have annual comparability unless I'm missing something. Mm-hmm. I don't.
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Kotek, you're correct. There's an annual is how our rates are done, so every year you have a different rate that you're comparing against. I think that's part of the statute, and that it's an every year comparability because all those things are dynamic.
Okay. Well, and it gets at the intent of the bill, which was to create the scale of a pool that could keep costs down. But thank you. That's helpful.
Are you on that board? Those are two different boards,
they're
right?
Separate boards.
The boards are independent.
I believe there is going to be a bill that would ask to merge PEB and OEB.
Yes. Isn't that in the House Fund Board report?
The House Fund Board has some language about encouraging that to happen, so we can get to that million people. The reason a bigger pool is always better than a smaller pool is that with small groups coming in, you don't affect the risk pattern of the bigger group. So, I mean, if you have a million people and you have a 500-person group coming in, however bad their experience is, it's not noticed. If you have a 500-people group with a really bad experience coming into a 15,000, then that experience really makes a difference. So you can stop worrying about the risk once you get to a certain point. Representative Thompson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to explore a little bit farther the annual reporting. I've spent a lot of my life preparing annual corporate reports for government, and that can be a very expensive situation. Do we have any data on what it costs districts or doesn't cost districts to prepare for their comparability study?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Thompson, the only thing that the district would have to send us is for three groups, the rate that they're paying for insurance, for health insurance, to us. So it should be a pretty small amount of information.
But how would you then get comparability on covered procedures and whatnot if all you have is the rate?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Thompson, I'm thinking of the comparability of cost was my reference. The comparability of plan design we have been doing, we're doing over these 3 years of the roll-in to make sure that the benefit designs offered are comparable to what currently exists. So in the future, I would expect that our main comparability assessment is going to be a cost comparability evaluation.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you very much for your service.
Yeah, that's, thank you.
It's very important to have folks involved in these kind of things.
Thank you.
Representative Barber. Mr. Barber, whoever.
Whoa.
Doug Barber, come on up here. And remember, they just shut off the heat, so there's no hurry. They shut off the heat at 5, and they'll shut off the lights at 5:17.
No, we do have control of the lights.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber. Even though I do have a lot of healthcare clients, I'm not representing any of them today. I'm here as an OWEB customer. My wife teaches in the Eugene School District, and so last session I watched all the debate and heard about, you know, the cost savings that we were going to see and the better benefits that we would receive. And so when I got the materials this fall, I was anxious, or last fall, I was anxious to look at them. Our out-of-pocket expense went up 28% under OWEB, and reduced benefit package, particularly on dependent coverage. I have two children who are 24 and 19. Dependent coverage is important to me, and it was a significant rollback in dependent coverage from what we had under the previous Regents plan through the district. So, you know, it's possible that on grand scale there are savings, but at the individual level, family by family, we sure didn't see it.
Any questions? Thank you very much for your personal testimony. That's good. I'm sorry, Representative Thompson.
Just a comment. I would echo that sentiment. My wife's a teacher, and we had went through the same thing. We didn't see the savings. It cost us more.
Okay.
However, just may I, maybe it's a question for OWEB Jones.
I'll ask him first. He knows a lot. See what he says.
I don't mean to be argumentative because I think the out-of-pocket cost for the actual consumer is important. Mm. But I think the savings that were intended, I just don't know how much we talked about that there would be savings on behalf of the individual. I don't know if we ever said that there might be more cost sharing, but I think the savings was about... I'm just saying, that's why I want to know. When we said savings, we were talking about the cost.
Yeah, you don't have to say anything about that.
To the school district, the cost of the state. I'm not saying that.
Be everybody.
I'm not saying that you shouldn't. That it's okay that you're paying more. I just think we should remember.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, my understanding of the way the Eugene School District's works is similar, I think, to a lot of districts, is that the district has a cap of how much they pay. And I can't remember the exact number. You know, it's $700 a month or $750 a month is the cap. And so if the policy is more than that, we pay the difference. Mm-hmm. And so if the policy is way more than that, or 28%, we pay... So no difference. To my understanding,
to me, that
it's no difference.
Regents
the district
this year wasn't. Mm.
Pardon?
No. I mean, on the non. Well, it was that, on that the non-experienced rated groups. It was 27% or something.
Well, because they had declines in year before.
I guess I mean the disconnect for me is that we going through the whole Oregon Health Fund Board discussion. You know, when Regents raised its individual rates 26%, people said, well, then, you know, that's a market failure. Mm-hmm. You know, and mine went up 28%, and that's the success.
Right. You got it.
And I don't get it. It just doesn't fit for me.
You mean your personal expenses went up 28%. But isn't that a function of the cap? I mean, if you have an $800 cap, and it's going to stay there, and healthcare costs is going up, whatever it is, then you're going to get hit by that cap, whatever. I mean, health health insurance is not going down. So, I mean, this wasn't a function. It was a function of the cap, wasn't it? I mean,
We just hadn't seen those kind of rate increases in the past. Mm. Yeah.
I would, Mr. Chair, represent Kotek. Mm. We talked about, I mean, this was going to save money that was going to be plowed back into the classroom to reduce classroom sizes.
Save money for the board, but he's not testifying he didn't save money for the board. He's testifying he didn't save money for...
It's irrelevant because they blew through the cap. So the school district saved zero. The employees paid more regardless because they blew through the cap.
There's
so there
cap,
was
that's true.
No savings.
Whatever they did. One
so
way
we reduced the classroom size by zero. The state saved nothing. And the consumer at the back end paid more.
Assuming that in the labor negotiation that cap stayed the same.
Regardless, you know, we don't. We can't compare it to what they could have bought. But the point was, the saving, this is supposed to reduce classroom size. Argued on the floor. I was there. You were too, sir.
I was. Do you have a measure of the effect on classroom size? I'm always looking for numbers.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for permitting these bills to be heard today, and I hope we can do it again.
And we move forward, I think, in a sense that PEB is going has sort of committed to to move in. We'll find out. I will follow up. Good. And I also,
I'm happy to carry on that conversation to the board. I'm mildly curious to see what comes up.
I am too.
Another announcement.
It's 5 years is a long time.
Yeah, it is.
And a lot of water's gone under the bridge, and I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Great. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2455, and unless somebody has something for the good of the order, I will adjourn.